Our reading this evening is from the Gospel of Luke, chapter 2, and we'll begin at verse 41. Luke, chapter 2, verse 41. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of the Passover. When he was 12 years old, they went up to the festival according to the custom. After the festival was over, while his parents were returning home, the boy Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem, but they were unaware of it. Thinking he was in their company, they travelled on for a day. Then they began looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they did not find him, they went back to Jerusalem to look for him. After 3 days, they found him in the temple courts, sitting among the teachers, listening to them and asking them questions. Everyone who heard him was amazed at his understanding and his answers. When his parents saw him, they were astonished. His mother said to him, "Son, why have you treated us like this? Your father and I have been anxiously searching for you." "Why were you searching for me?" he asked. "Didn't you know I had to be in my father's house?" But they did not understand what he was saying to them. Then he went down to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. But his mother treasured all these things in her heart. And Jesus grew in wisdom and stature and in favor with God and man. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. The Lord be with you. Thanks so much. I always feel like I get the benefit of more voices. You just get one voice. I get everybody else kind of sharing stuff back again. It's good to be together tonight. We're on a journey through Luke's gospel. We're just beginning and we're going to carry on for some time, although we're going to interject with other stuff as we go. But I'm excited. Have you been reading Luke's gospel at home? Not overwhelming, I have to say. Good. It would be great if you do. Just enjoy the journey. I'm discovering new stuff as I'm looking into it again. And we're going to be the more you do it, the more fun it becomes. Trust me on that. If you go around it a few times, you just discover more and more things as you go. So I'm sharing a few things tonight that I've discovered for the first time that I didn't notice before, and hopefully they'll help somewhere along the line for some of you. So here's a picture of Jerusalem in Jesus' time. And God bless those people who have fun making these pictures to look like they do and make models and superimpose them with real-life Jerusalem and make it work. Because that really helps, doesn't it? It gives you a sense of the scale of the city. It's not huge, you know, a little house, you know, just... I mean, so I don't know how big this thing is, but the temple is clearly the biggest thing in the picture, isn't it? I mean, the Temple Mount... which is about the same size as it is today as it was in those days. So you can measure things out from there. But the temple is huge, isn't it, in comparison to... And of course, the people lived in very small houses in those days. They didn't come from around here, did they? They didn't live in my house anyway. Yeah. So the temple loomed large. And that had a massive impact on them emotionally, and you can see how physically it would have had an impact on them. But can you imagine coming up to Jerusalem, and you know the temple just shines, doesn't it? And it draws. This is the holy hill. This is the holy mountain, and it's got the temple at the top, which we know is where heaven and earth touch. And well, we'll get into that a bit later on. And so this is the setting of the story that we're following with Jesus, and the place is filled with people. Thousands of people. So Jerusalem had several thousand people, but of course when there were several festivals in each year where everybody would leave their home and they traveled towards Jerusalem, and the thing would swell to hundreds of thousands. So it would be completely packed. And another amazing picture of what it would look like with the temple filled with people. And you can see the inner courts, the outer courts, and the balconies and all the rest of it. And this is where Jesus was. And so you can imagine the scene where, because there's so many people, you know, it was busier than the Christmas market even. And it's easy to lose your kids in those times, isn't it? And in fact, you're not that bothered about it, are you, really, to be honest? As long as they're happy, or as long as they're not with you for half an hour. That's quite nice, isn't it? Anyway, so that happened with Mary and Joseph. I don't know whether they're anxious or not. They seem incredibly chilled. 5 days it took them to find their son. That is quite chilled and relaxed, isn't it? I'm sure that Tori would have been nagging me for a little bit quicker. You know, have you seen Jesus? Have you? I don't know. I think she probably would have been on me. You know, I'm sure I left him with you. It would have been my fault. Anyway, so Joseph and Mary have gone on the way, and that's because the whole community would have come, and they would just assume that he was with us. A bit like New Wine. Anyone been to New Wine or a festival like that? You just assume that your kids are safe, don't you? And so this is the environment. So Jesus is happy, and the kids are happy. Everyone's happy, and they're doing their thing. They're doing this. But it's not just any time of year. What time of year is it? Passover. You know the story. Well done. You read it. You remembered. That's good. And Jesus is found 5 days later in the temple, and he says, well, in the first one, I said, why did you look for me? You know, he's kind of like irritatingly opinionated, even at 12. Anyone else have a 12-year-old? You know what that's like. It's like, duh. But he goes, you know, I would be in my father's house. So that's how we translate it in our Bibles, in father's house. It doesn't actually say house. It actually says about my father's things. And so the traditions have put it into my father's, because it's set in the temple. They've kind of put the two together. But he really said, well, of course I'd be doing my father's things, and I'd be amongst his things. And of course he means the temple. But isn't that, I quite like that. He was always an apprentice to his father. What I see the father doing, I want to do, he said later on, didn't he? So he's trying to be in the father's things. Do you remember your dad's drawers? Your dad's, you know, did he have a study or a place where he had dad drawers? You know, Michael McIntyre does a brilliant thing about the dad drawer. Do you ever go into your dad's study or office or room or garage or whatever it is, and you'd find his stuff, and hours would pass, you know, in your dad's things, amongst your dad's things. And then your dad would come in, and you'd close the door very quickly, for shame had caught you, or something. As if my dad was an amazing stationery collector, and he always had the best felt tip pen collection in the world. And so when our felt tip pens ran out, my dad's drawers were the place to go. But they were my dad's felt tip pens, not ours. But I was often found amongst my dad's things. Yeah. He wanted to be like his dad, so he was amongst his dad's things. And he was doing what he did best. Isn't this a great picture? It's a great picture of Jesus shining brightly on the picture. That's how often Jesus is shining brightly. And what I love about this, I mean, there's all sorts of things to love in a picture, isn't it? I love the way that an artist will meditate on a story and then just give us time. You have to sit in front of a picture, don't you? But have you noticed in this picture that no one's looking at Jesus? It's a nice depiction, is it? So Jesus is teaching, but he's just pointing up to his Father in heaven, which is really cool, pointing up to him. So he's pointing away from himself towards his Father in heaven, which I really like. But I love the fact that he's whatever he said, everyone's gone, oh, I don't know, what do you think? And they're kind of chatting. I love the guy over here who's kind of, his hand is going all the way around the top of his head to scratch something as if thinking. It's a great pose for thinking. Like Tom is at the back, just kind of really thinking. He's now moved his hands. But and one guy's studying scriptures, and the others are kind of like, they're really wrestling with it. And you can see the guy with the glasses over here. He's just kind of like, just looking to really inspect. What is Jesus doing? He's unraveling something, and they're inquisitive, and their mood is enlivened, and they're excited. And you know, like those conversations which go on, and didn't your heart warm within us sort of conversations, where you're kind of like, you're having a conversation with someone and time passes really quickly. Like 5 days worth of conversation pass really quickly, and you're just in the midst of a conversation and you don't want it to end. even though it's 11 o'clock at night and it's time to go home. It's just gone too quickly. It feels to me like this picture, kind of snapshot of this. Oh, they're just in it, aren't they? Loving it with Jesus in the center. And there are two things that I want us to notice tonight, that Luke sets Jesus' story in. In fact, he's already done quite a bit of it already, but he's reinforcing it in this story. And there are two aspects, the bookends of Luke's story, or at least the gospel bit, and goes on into Acts. And the first is that he puts it in the temple. Have you noticed that already? We've been looking at Anna and Zechariah and Elizabeth, and they're all in the temple, aren't they? And then Mary and Joseph bring Jesus to the temple, and then there's another story of the temple. Now, why is Luke telling a story about the temple all the time to Gentiles who don't have the temple? Well, I think one of the reasons is he's trying to just remind Gentile Christians, because he's the only Gentile writer of the New Testament, he's trying to remind Gentile Christians not to rubbish the temple, not to rubbish Judaism, not to get rid of. He wants to place Jesus within his context, make sense of Jesus. So he's reinforcing that point. And he also, I think, he's trying to reinforce the point that Jesus is the fulfillment of the story. Because if you understand where Jesus comes from, then he makes more sense. So I think he's trying to fill in the blanks, which for us is helpful too, isn't it? Because we've got lots of blanks. And we need Jesus. So the story of Luke helps us to fill in some of the blanks of how do we make sense of this Jesus for Gentiles, for those of us who weren't Jews, who weren't born of Jews. So the one is the temple and the other is Passover, which is the setting of this story. Now, we're right at the beginning of the story, but guess where the story ends? It doesn't it? See what I did there? It's good, isn't it? That Luke is telling the story. He starts the story off in the temple and with Passover. And then, well, it's not Luke's narrating it, isn't it? But Jesus does it. But Luke wants us to know. No, this story, no, nobody else has got. Why is Luke squeezed in this story? Why has he found space for this story? Maybe he's just reiterating the point. Luke, you know, no one else has quite the same beginning to the story that Luke does. Those narratives about the temple and Passover, those are Luke's stories. Mark just goes straight in. The kingdom of God is at hand. You know, Mark just straight in, boom. But Luke wants us to place it so that the end of the story over here, which happens at the end in the temple and with Passover, the last night of Jesus' life, Passover meal. He's trying to put, that makes sense, doesn't it? Do you think I'm right? What do you think? You're nodding, thanks. That's really sweet of you. For those that didn't nod, wake up. You've nodded off. So we've got a bit on the temple and a bit on Passover. You with me? Yeah? Happy with that? So what does the temple do? The temple is a place of union. I'm going to go through these one by one. It's a place of meeting. It's a place of prayer. Those two things kind of combine to prayer. So in the temple, there's incense rising up to heaven, and it's a place of connection. It's a place of meeting and union. And so prayer is really central to the temple's life all the way through. My house shall be a house of prayer, says Jesus when he comes into the temple right at the end. It's also a place of cleansing. It's a place of sacrifice. Lots of different kinds of sacrifice. We'll touch on that. And it's a place of identity. Okay, let's go through a few of these. You know the word for temple. The first, before we had a temple, we had a tabernacle. So Moses, the story of Exodus, you know, God says, "This, I want you to make a tent, a tabernacle." And Mishkan is the Hebrew word, and it means a residence or dwelling place or rest. It's the sofa. It's where you dwell. It's a place of abiding. I'm trying to look like I'm relaxing. I can't. You know, because it's not the place of action. It's not the kitchen. It's not the garage. It's not the garden. It's the sofa. Next time you sit down on the sofa like that, people think he's a bit strange. Why is he sitting down like this on the sofa? It's the place of rest, dwelling. Because what do you do on a sofa? You chat. You're not going anywhere, are you? It's really irritating when you're on the sofa and someone says, "Oh, Richard, could you..." Oh, I've just sat down. I'm not getting you, Tori. I'm just illustrating the point. I'm just going to... A lot of men in the room are going, "Yeah, I know exactly what he means. Yeah, yeah, yeah." It's a place of dwelling, isn't it? And when you dwell, you want to kick off your shoes. You want to relax. This is the dwelling place of God with us. where he wants to relax, kick off his shoes. That's a beautiful image I've just made up. Maybe that's why we have to take off our shoes. I don't know. Maybe that is why we have to take off our shoes. I don't know. I've just made that up. Here you go. Bit of theology on the hoof. It's that lovely idea that God just wants to dwell and relax with us. So he creates a special place where heaven and earth meets, and God relaxes with us, rests with us, and then he gives us a day to enjoy him. A sofa day, which none of us take. That's another point. What else is it? It's a place of meeting. Exodus 33, as Moses went into the tent, the pillar of cloud would come down and stay at the entrance while the Lord, Yahweh, spoke with Moses. Whenever the people saw the pillar of cloud standing at the entrance of the tent, they all stood and worshipped. That was close enough for them. They just kind of, woo. Each at the entrance to their tent. They wouldn't go to the tent. They stayed in their tent. But the Lord would speak to Moses face to face. Face to face. That's a beautiful line, isn't it? Face to face. You know those conversations you have when you're speaking face to face with someone? It's more than just like you're looking at each other, but it's like a meeting of face to faceness. It's a rare thing, isn't it, when we see each other and we feel seen and we see them and we walk away from those conversations because they feel different to the other kinds of conversations we have. You know, at the checkout, when you're seeing someone at the checkout, you might have your earphones in or if you're young and cool and trendy and things. Or you might just ignore them because they're just blipping and you don't meet them face to face, even though their face is there. And then there's those conversations where you do and you see people and they see you, and that's a different kind of... So Moses is having this face to face with God. It's beautiful, isn't it? It's a place of meeting, connection. As one speaks to a friend. Don't you love the Bible sometimes? It's like it fills it in. Anyone got a friend? Please say yes. Phew, Billy No Mates in the room. No, isn't that beautiful? When we have our friends, and it's like that's what Moses... Isn't that a beautiful idea that Moses, everyone else was a long way away at their tent, and then Moses is not. He's in the tent with God, face to face, like a friend on the sofa. I must stop doing that every time I do sofa. Okay, the tabernacle is not just a place of meeting and union, although that's beautiful, isn't it? It's also a place of washing, purifying, and consecrating. It's a place of cleansing. So there are lots of symbols that are part of the temple, which are part and parcel of this. And one of them is a great big basin, a great big bath, a bronze bath. And it's obvious that that's for cleansing, because that's what we all do. Kind of fill a bath with water. And there was lots of ritual cleansing. All sorts of things got cleansed. But it was also blood was used for cleansing. Have you read those little bits in Leviticus and Exodus where it talks about cleansing with hyssop? You dip the hyssop into, hyssop is the brush, into the blood. And then you sprinkle places and things and people with the blood. And they become clean when it's like a disinfectant. The blood cleanses the Holy of Holies or Aaron and his robes. Because we're dirty, aren't we? We pick up dirt, don't we, very easily. And we pick up dirt, and then we pick up metaphorical dirt, like rubbish. It seems to clog to us, doesn't it? We're like Velcro with dirt, isn't it? It just sticks to us. So what do? We need a place of getting rid of this dirt, because we're coming close on the sofa with God, and so dirt, we don't want dirt in this place. We don't want any of that stuff. So God creates a way of getting that cleansed. And there are lots of different ways of cleansing. It's not like there's just one way of getting it cleansed. But can you see how cleansing is good? And it's necessary and it's normal. And God needs to kind of demonstrate it very powerfully in symbolic ways. So and real ways, not just symbolic ways, but real ways. He needs the people to be clean. He wants them to be clean. The idea of God was that he would create the earth. He would create the earth. I make it deliberately a square because I think Genesis 1, you could read it as the creation of a temple, a tabernacle, where God dwells. But instead of he walks in the garden, doesn't he? He walks in the garden. But what does he put in the garden? He puts his icons. his image bearers in the garden. He puts his statues, the living God puts his living statues in the tabernacle. And so can you see how an impure living statue would be the wrong kind of statue? So he's always trying to get back to that bit where we can be who we're supposed to be, so that we can be clean representatives of the king who reflects the glory of this, which is what happens to Moses, isn't it? So he gets close to God and he begins to shine, like the dirt falls off him, and he begins to glow and becomes more than clean. So are you with me on this? Are you enjoying this? It's good. I haven't got another talk if you're not enjoying it. This is what I've got. But it's holiness. Holiness, just going back to holiness, is not just goodness, although it is goodness. Holiness is like with the wedding dress, which is holy, isn't it? You don't wear that on a Monday, do you? Or Tuesday, or kind of other days of the week. And you certainly don't, you keep it clean. Because it's a holy thing. It's holy as in it's special and set apart for a reason. And so he creates us to be holy, set apart for a reason. And he wants us to demonstrate and be his beautiful beings who demonstrate his stewardship and his glory on the earth. And he chose you and me to do this. It's beautiful, isn't it? So we need holinessing. I made that up. We need to become holy again, which takes us onto these things. So sacrifice is a place of sacrifice, and that's just one of the ways that we get put right with God. And now, it's not only put right with God, it's also how we get put right with one another, sacrifice, or how we build relationships with one another. So if you give a meal to someone else, that's a sacrifice, isn't it? Because the reality is that one of you has spent more than another person, isn't it? The person who's hosted the meal has put more into the cost of the event than the other person who's just eating. And they say, thank you very much. And they sacrifice a little bit too. They bring a bottle of wine or something like that. This is how we do it. We sacrifice to one another. And it builds relationships, doesn't it? It builds connections. So these are different kinds of sacrifices. Burnt offerings, fellowship offerings, grain offerings. And then there's sin offerings as well. Because obviously that's part of it. And it really is to get rid of the sin or to deal with the sin. And that's part of the temple's business, is to help us to decontaminate ourselves. And then there's this beautiful day called the Day of At-One-ment or Atonement, where we're connected, reconnected, and all the sin, like all the kind of accumulated sins of the whole year, are put on. Well, it's put on the scapegoat, you know, or the and the priest. Contaminates himself deliberately with the people, and then he takes all the sin, as if he kind of gathers up the contamination of all the people, and he places it on the scapegoat, and then sends that goat away. But there is a clean goat, and then that goat is killed, but is killed in a different way, and the blood of that goat is then taken into the Holy of Holies, and that's a different kind of cleansing. So the one that dies by bleeding and the blood that cleanses is a different to the one that takes it away, which is important when we get to Jesus, because we need to know which he is, because he's the clean. He's, although maybe the sin gets put on him and he gets sent out as well, so maybe he's both. And then it's about identity. The temple is about identity. Exodus 33 again. If your presence, God says to Moses, I'll go with you. And Moses says, well, you're blooming better, because if you don't go with us, then how will they know that we're any different from anyone else? We might do a Christmas market, but how would they know we're any different from anyone else unless it's filled with the Spirit, unless it's filled with your presence in some way? If your presence does not go with us, Moses replied, do not lead us up from here. I'd rather stay put. For how can it be known that your people and I have found favor in your sight unless you go with us? How else will we be distinguished from all the other people on the face of the earth? And so the temple is this place where the kind of stamping of God's identity on the people. They keep, it's the presence, it's the place of presence. And so they have to carry the presence with them. So they put the temple on poles. And they carried it around. They had a special group of people who were temple people, and they had to carry it. And they were, you with me on this? So the presence has to go with, so the temple always has to go with us wherever we go. Or that's what Moses said. What about Passover? Okay, Passover is a place of liberation. It's a place of judgment It's a place of faith and trust. It's a place of sacrifice, and it's a place of identity once again. So let's just have a look at these. Liberation. I mean, isn't it? I mean, you know the story. Moses, let my people go and all that. Yeah? Exodus 6. This is God telling Moses what to say to the Israelites who are not going to believe him, because he's going to ask them to trust him, that he's going to liberate them from the hardest, crushing, most brutal regime that the earth has ever known up to that point. And so they're these incredibly poor, broken, crushed people who are there only because they have to be. And they're crushed under the weight of this incredible regime, and they've lost all hope completely. It's worse than the European Union. It's much worse. That woke a few of you up. Yeah, so there you go. Therefore, I say to the Israelites, I am the Lord. And that's why I highlighted the I statements. So this is God saying, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to liberate you. And he says, I will bring you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians. I will free you from being slaves to them. I will redeem you with an outstretched arm. In other words, you know, like, I'm ready. I'm going to sort them. Outstretched arm, and with mighty acts of judgment, we'll get onto that in a minute, I will take you as my own people. I'll take you, gather you as my own people. I will be your God. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, who brought you out from under the yoke of the Egyptians, and I will bring you to the land I swore with uplifted hand to give to Abraham. Great image. To Isaac and to Jacob. I will give it to you as a possession, for I am Yahweh. I am who I am. This is me. It's my name. So Passover is the act when the whole nation would gather together and go, Yahweh, the I am who he is here among us, and he's the liberating God. And they would reenact this story, and of course they would all get excited because they're living in Jesus' day, living under Roman occupation. So they're weighed down again by another brutal regime, and they would have sung this song, revolution song, as Josh puts it. What about judgment? This is important for us because have you read the stories of the plagues and what happens? It's not easy reading, is it? And I've spent a lot of the week trying to wrestle with this stuff. I almost had another sermon about this because it caught my attention and it made me feel very uncomfortable. But it's really important. I'm not going to do that other sermon. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. Of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. The focus of God's attention is not the people or the animals, but it's the gods behind the people and the animals. And there's a demonic force, there's a power and principality of this dark age that is oppressing the people. And God's got to take them out. He's got to take the gods out. He's got to take the little gods, the ones that have outgrown their identity and they've become too big for their own boots, and they're oppressing people. And he's heard the cries of the Israelites, and they've come to his ear, and he's cross. Like, he's not just cross, he's crosser than I could be cross, because that would be wrong to shout like that at you. But he was like, he's furious, because this is wrong. Have you felt that wrongness sometimes? The fire of anger that burns within you sometimes. You see something on telly, and it's wrong. And something needs to be done. Something needs to be done. And God acts out of that anger and wrath that is not indiscriminate. It's not the irritability that we suffer from, you know, the kind of narkiness that comes. It's not God being narky. No, he's bearing the suffering of the poorest and of his own people, and he's seeing the crushing burden that people are putting on top of one another, and he's got to judge it. He's got to cleanse it, and so he wreaks havoc with these people so that they will let his people go. It's a terrifying story of judgment. And Jesus does the same, just to say. Jesus has a terrifying story of judgment. And you'll notice if you see from chapter 10 or 11, I think it is, maybe it's 12, in Luke's gospel, he steps off towards Jerusalem. From that moment on, whenever Jesus is going towards Jerusalem, which really means he's going towards the temple and towards Passover, as he goes towards that, he's got lots of messages of judgment. Enjoy reading those. I mean, they're very serious. I don't know whether I should have chosen Luke, because it's so full of judgment. Jesus is full of judgment against the powers and principalities because he's angry. There's a fire of anger about him, and he ends up in the temple. Do you remember that? And what does he look like in the temple? Nice and quiet? No, he's angry because the powers and principalities have even taken over his father's house. Yeah. Sometimes we're not angry enough. Sometimes we're too angry, but angry about the wrong things. And sometimes we're not angry enough as Jesus' followers. Anyway, Jesus is following in his father's footsteps and he's angry. Exodus 8, this is about faith and trust. And this is an insight I've never had before, if you're still with me. Then Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, go sacrifice to the Lord your God there in the land. Pharaoh says, why don't you just get on with your... If you want to go... Because Pharaoh's got this... Moses has got this story. We need to leave in order to sacrifice. That's what God's told him. And Pharaoh goes, well, why don't you just sacrifice here? Why don't you do your sacrifice of a lamb here? But have you noticed that in Egypt, every single thing is a... Like even a frog is a god. Or a gnat is a god. Everything is a god, which is why God sends them and gets rid of them and has power over them. But lambs are gods. So if you kill a lamb in... It's actually a capital offense to kill a lamb in Egypt. So Moses goes, well, it would be detestable. But Moses said that would not be right. The sacrifices we offer the Lord our God would be detestable to the Egyptians. If we killed a lamb, you'd stone us. And if we offered sacrifices that are detestable in their eyes, will they not stone us? We must take a 3-day journey into the wilderness to offer the sacrifices to the Lord our God as he commands us. Does that make sense? We'll come onto that in a moment. Well, in fact, let's do it now. What does it mean then when on the night of this Passover night that they put the blood of the lamb on their doorposts? You live next door to an Egyptian or across the road from an Egyptian and you get some blood and you put it on your doorposts. Have you noticed what Bill's doing across the road? He's putting blood of a killed animal, our God, on the doorposts. This is provocative. And can you see how for the Israelites this would have been a statement of faith? We believe that we can do this sacrifice here and God will protect us. So they do this incredible thing. They put the blood over themselves as a statement of faith against all those who are looking in on them. And then it's a place of sacrifice. Of course, the Passover sacrifice is not like others, but it is a death of an animal, isn't it? And it's a particular kind of... It's a clean animal. It's a firstborn animal. It has to no blemishes and all that sort of thing. When your children ask you, what does this ceremony mean to you? Then tell them, it is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. It was a terrible night. Terrible night as God went over and killed everyone who didn't have the blood of the lamb over their doors. Suffered. The firstborn child was killed. Their firstborn was killed. But instead, the firstborn lamb, well, that lamb died, and that lamb protected the Israelites because they had the blood of the lamb over their door. And then Passover is a story of identity. The observance will be for you like a sign on your hand and a reminder on your forehead, which kind of is like the doorpost, isn't it? On your hands and on your head. I thought that. The Lord is to be on your lips, for the Lord brought you out of Egypt with his mighty hand. You must keep this ordinance at the appointed time every year. So they do it again and again because it stamps their identity. Who are you? We're Passover people. And it kept them going even when they were oppressed. And can you see how Jesus is all of these things for us? He's our liberation. He's also the one who judges and comes to judge. Or he's the only rightful judge. In fact, or maybe perhaps we want to say that he is the one who takes on the judgment upon his shoulders. He takes the curse upon himself. He becomes the lamb. He's also the one who is the most faithful, the trusting one, who demonstrates that God will protect me even if I suffer. The sacrifice, God will protect me. I will be raised on the third day. He's the most faithful Israelite that has ever lived. He's the place of sacrifice, and he's the one in whom we find our identity. And when we place ourselves in him, we get his everything that he has. And can you see how Jesus is the temple? Everything that was the temple is Jesus. He is a place of union with God, and then it becomes helps us to have that union with God. And he is a place of meeting. He is the sofa. A Sabbath rest is how Hebrews puts it. He is the place of cleansing, and he is the sacrifice, the one that lays down his life for even for his enemies, not just for his friends. And again, it becomes, and we remind ourselves again and again that this is the place of identity. This is where we get our identity from. So both these two things come together in Jesus' life. And you know that Paul talks about the temple. He notices that Jesus is the temple, and then he says, and you are the temple. Jesus has become, the presence of God has become liberated into us as a people. So how should that temple be? Well, it should be like the temple. It should be clean and pure and washed and cleansed. And how does it get washed and cleansed? Well, through the sacrifices and through the gift of Jesus to us. And then what did Jesus leave us? He didn't give us a theology. He left us with a meal to reenact again and again this identity stamp upon us. Who are we? We're the Jesus meal people. And we gather around it week after week, sometimes day after day in some traditions, just so that we become the Passover people. And we remind ourselves, why do you do this? Our kids might ask, why do we go to church and do communion? Interesting, the children should be involved a bit more. I'll leave that with you. The children should see it, so they ask questions. They should see enough of it to ask questions. It should make no sense to them, and then they should ask questions. And then you have to explain it. And they should ask the question, and we should say, well, we are Jesus' people. We're washed by him. It was a gift, not our own. And we were cursed, but we've been forgiven, and we've been set free. We've been liberated from the powers of sin and darkness. I love this. You know what this picture is? It's a picture about Jesus. It's called Agnus Dei, the Lamb of God. It's by Spanish. He's called the Spanish Caravaggio. Some of you don't know who Caravaggio, so that doesn't mean it is, so it doesn't make any sense. But isn't it a beautiful picture? This is a picture of Jesus, the Lamb of God who takes away the sin of the world. And we kind of merge all these stories together. They're not just one story. They're all the stories. Jesus becomes all of them in some way. And Paul summarizes it this in Romans 8, the climax of his argument in Romans 8. He says, therefore, there is no condemnation for those who are in Christ Jesus. Because through Christ Jesus, the law of the Spirit, the law of the presence of God, this presence of God, this breath of God who gives life and has set you free, liberated you from the law of sin and death that has put its weight upon you and made you a slave. For what the law was powerless to do because it was weakened by the flesh, God did by sending his own Son in the likeness of sinful flesh to be a sin offering. He becomes the sin offering within the temple. And so he condemned sin in the flesh. Do you see how Jesus, he's not being condemned. Sin is being condemned in the flesh in Jesus. Like Pharaoh is being condemned, so sin is being condemned in the flesh, in order that the righteous requirement of the law might be fully met in us, who do not live according to the flesh, but according to the breath of God that is within us. So how therefore shall we live is the next sentence. How therefore shall we live? Let us live, brothers and sisters, as temple people and as Passover people. That's where the story begins, and it's where the story ends.